What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham.
Mark Latham.
G'day, Mark.
G'day, Brent. It's funny what you say about hyphenated names. It makes me chuckle because my father, who's long dead, had a saying. I don't exactly know why he said it, but he said, "Never trust anyone with a hyphenated name." Probably not a bad adage. I don't know what evidence he had, but through life, it's probably more often true than not.
Okay, all right, I'll leave that alone. I will. Let's get stuck into some of the stories this week. Leaked texts have laid bare the breakdown in Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles' relationship with his chief of staff, who is alleging that a troubling culture of bullying in the office forced her to resign. The former chief of staff alleges she was driven from the job after she was bullied in Mr. Marles' office. It asked that those who have enabled his behaviour, or this behaviour, not necessarily his behaviour, but enabled this behaviour, to be held accountable. Now, of course, Richard Marles is not accused of the bullying here. We need to make that clear. He hasn't been accused of the bullying. It's just happened in his office. Mark, this worker is on $300,000 a year. She hasn't worked since May. My goodness me, they're paying the fill-in for her, obviously similar sort of money. It looks as though this could have gone on until the next election, if she and herself had not come forward at that press conference this week.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point that hasn't received a lot of attention elsewhere in the media, Brent. In the middle of a cost of living crisis, how can someone be working for 5 months on $300,000 a year and not doing their job? Now, Richard Marles advised her back in April, you really should look for alternative employment. Well, if he had reason to say that, he had reason to dismiss her and to save the taxpayer all that money over the past 6 months. So that in itself, I think, is a bad reflection on the Albanese government. The other vital point, of course, is that in opposition, Labor set a very, very high standard in the Brittany Higgins matter for how ministers should behave, how the culture in Federal Parliament House should unfold. And it's incredible to think that Joe Tanasky, the Chief of Staff, complained to her boss, Richard Marles, about bullying of her elsewhere in the office. Not him, but other staff members were bullying her. She couldn't handle that, apparently. It was under pressure as the Chief of Staff, and his response, effectively, was to say to her, well, maybe you're at fault and you need to find a different job. So it doesn't sound like how... Wouldn't you investigate the bullying claims if you're the employer, as Marles effectively is? I've headed several political offices over the years, and if a staff member said that to me, I'd investigate the nature of the bullying and find out whether or not it's true, take action against the bully if it was needed. But instead, he's left someone in limbo on good money for 6 months, and as you say, Brent, if she hadn't have come out with this press conference to tell the world about all this, it would have stayed secret until to the next election or even beyond. So I think Marles has a lot to answer for here, and after they set that high standard in the Brittany Higgins matter, perhaps Marles shouldn't be in his job.
Well, look, I just know in any office these days, not offices of Parliament, but in any office these days, there are processes in place that you have to follow, that management has to follow, if a staff member makes an accusation of bullying against anybody else in that workplace.
Yeah, there's outside advice you can receive. There's all counselling services and legal advice available to someone like Richard Marles, but he effectively is the manager. In a political office with the staff you've got, you're the manager as the MP, and if there's a problem, it's your public duty to try and identify it and fix it. So he could have investigated these claims of bullying. We still don't know whether or not they were valid, or what attempts Richard Marles made to get to the heart of the matter instead of telling the Chief of Staff to move on to other employment. So it seems very, very strange indeed. We'll hear more about it. I mean, it's not inconsequential. He's the Deputy Prime Minister of Australia and the Defence Minister. So there's high stakes here, and I think Miles needs to be held to account. I don't think there's any excuse for him not investigating and finding out whether or not it was true. If it was true, it's the bullies who should have been told to find a different job instead of Joe Tanarski.
Absolutely, yeah. The Prime Minister seems to be under a little pressure. It all sort of came to a head last week. He had to apologise for making offensive comments during question time, where he mocked opposition members for asking if they had Tourette syndrome. Disability advocates criticised the remark, saying it set a bad example, and the Prime Minister quickly withdrew and explained. Look, he expanded on his apology. In fact, he said on record that he knew as soon as he'd made the comments it was the wrong thing to say. The incident adds to a series of moments where the Prime Minister has become somewhat frustrated, such as during the heated radio interview that we saw and heard. There was the public rally. Mark, should a Prime Minister allow themselves to reveal frustration in challenging situations, or should they basically always stay composed? And is the pressure starting to get to the Prime Minister? And this is evidence of that.
Well, you know, everyone in a senior political role is human, of course, and people make mistakes or they react under pressure in a way they might later regret. I'm not too sure it's the worst thing in the world that he said. It wasn't meant literally. It's a figure of speech, and unfortunately now in the world of political correctness and censorship, every figure of speech is taken literally. But the broader point about Albanese is that, Brent, I think he lost his political confidence and has been underperforming ever since The Voice was smashed down by the Australian people. I know of a fellow who spoke to Albanese at the beginning of last year, and Albanese, questioned about The Voice, said, this will win easily. The Australian people will support that. We've got polling. We've got the evidence to say this will walk in. The referendum will be carried later in 2023. So I think he got a shock that that judgment was completely wrong. He was humiliated with The Voice vote. And I think he lost his confidence in his own judgment in the opinions of the Australian people. And since then, especially with the cost of living crisis, the sort of stumbles that you've mentioned, he's been under heavy pressure. Labor's been going down in the polls. And I'm sure an increasing number of Canberra journalists will be asking, will Labor do to Albanese what they did to Kevin Rudd and axe him in the middle of the night? So I don't think that will happen, but all that speculation will add to the Prime Minister's problems.
Yeah, that's true. Now, look, this summit between New South Wales and South Australia to address the harm of social media on young people was held last week. The New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, said it is more obvious than ever that a nationwide ban on social media for children is necessary. But at the end of the day, now, I believe they've put the responsibility back on to the social media companies.
Well, yeah, is this workable? Can a ban actually achieve, in practice, prohibition on 14-year-olds, for example, 14 and younger, using social media? I would have thought it's very easy to avoid the ban. People use fake accounts, or parents who don't agree with the ban would say, here, do your stuff on my phone, and on it goes. Social media has so many outlets, it would be very hard to administer the ban. So it sounds like government doesn't know what to do. It sounds like Chris Minns and, to some extent, Albanese are just riding a populist wave to sound empathetic to parents worried about social media. There are some issues out there. But I think we also need to dive deeper into the evidence. Where's the firm evidence in survey and other work that young people are suffering horrendously? I know there's some bad cases, and you can read out letters and accounts in isolated cases, and they're dreadful and a great tragedy, of course. But there's an American sociologist called Jonathan Hake who's produced one book. So there's one book out there saying that social media is destroying the lives and rewiring the brains of young people across the planet. But that's just one book, and there's other academic material that contradicts that. Either says the problem's not so bad, or the problem, in fact, is sort of like cross currents. There's some good things about social media for young people, and there's some bad things, and it's how you manage the bad things that's the key to this debate. So I'd like a lot more research, a lot more public scrutiny, instead of relying on one book by an American sociologist to have these summits and make these popular statements.
The New South Wales government is going to introduce two new offences, new court orders, and a series of other changes in a bid to strengthen laws around domestic violence. The Premier said the changes send the message that the justice system prioritises the safety of victim survivors. This all happened last week. Plus, I believe that serious perpetrators are going to have to wear ankle bracelets as well, and it will be decided as to who does and who doesn't have to wear those ankle bracelets by the judiciary themselves.
Well, these are people charged but not convicted. And one of the long-standing principles, a very important principle of our legal system, has always been innocent until proven guilty. And, you know, it does raise the matter of the fairness and that principle standing up. But you'd have people charged with serious domestic violence who are treated like criminals and have to wear ankle bracelets. I think what we're going to see here is people having those bracelets for a long, long time because of the clogged up court system. It takes a long, long while to get these matters heard in the court. The police commissioner has said the new coercive control laws are something of a nightmare in their administration for the police. They've got specialist detectives dealing with cases that will take a long time to sort out, and then if they come to the court, again a long time to be heard and resolved. So I just come back to the basic point. You want to do something about domestic violence, keep the perpetrators in jail for a longer period of time.
Yeah.
They won't do that because they also have a policy not to jail Indigenous people. And there's a high rate of domestic violence in remote Indigenous communities, unfortunately. So trapped with that, the government then looks at other solutions like the bracelets, which, as my colleague Rod Roberts, a former police officer, points out, there's no monitoring in country areas or many country areas because there's no police stationed there 24/7 to do the monitoring. So, you know, again, it's Chris Minns wanting to look like he's doing something when in practice there's a lot of problems with his so-called solution.
Yeah. We're having a royal visit. They arrive on Friday, the King and Queen, and I see there's a story today that says support for an Australian Republic has fallen to a lower level under King Charles than it was during the reign of Queen Elizabeth. This is a new survey. Only 33% of Australians apparently at the moment want a republic. It got to 40% or 39.4% voted that way in 1999. Now it's dropped to 33%. 45% said Australia should remain a constitutional monarchy. 22% said they were unsure.
Yeah, well, and Albanese's got rid of his minister for creating the republic. So it's all headed the other way. I mean, it's a big blow to the republican advocates like Peter Fitzsimons and Craig Foster, the former soccer player who now heads the Australian Republican Movement, that this has happened under King Charles. Because if you go back to the debate and the referendum in 1999, Brent, it was always said once Queen Elizabeth passed away, an unpopular Charles takes the throne, that's when the Republicans in Australia could strike. That's when public opinion would turn against the monarchy. Well, it sounds like the reverse has happened. And previous opinions of Charles have been replaced by the, I suppose, moderate job he's been doing, the sympathy for the cancer that he's battling, the stability that he's provided. Everyone thought maybe, you know, he'd go a bit wild in office, but he hasn't done that. So, yeah, the Republic in Australia is a bit of a non-issue, really, not just because of those opinion numbers you quoted, but in a cost-of-living crisis, people would think there's many, many more important things for government to sort out, like housing affordability, than fluffing around with the Republic. So it's not going to happen, and I expect their visit will be quite a success. Probably the most significant thing about their visit, Brent, in Sydney is what they're not doing. They're not going to the races at Randwick to present the King Charles Stakes Trophy, and they're not coming to the New South Wales Legislative Council, where we're celebrating 200 years of either partial or full democracy in our state. So it's a limited schedule they've got because of the health battles that the King has been struggling with. But one trusts that it'll be a successful visit and they will be popular when they come here.
It's interesting how things turn and turn quickly at times. If you remember when Prince Harry and Meghan Markle came to Australia, I think it was 2018, they were just so popular. There were people talking about how they should come and live in Australia and be the King's representatives in Australia. Well,
that's not happening.
That's not happening. I mean, in this survey, 56% of people questioned in the survey dislike Harry now, so he's on the nose. But wait, his wife Meghan Markle or Meghan Markle, 71% of people don't like her at all.
Well, she always comes across as a bit self-serving. It's all about her, and that's one trait Australians definitely wouldn't like. So that's not surprising. They're rebels against the royal family that still seems popular, and against the popularity numbers of William and Kate. Of course, Harry and Meghan Markle, they're outcasts in their own family and in public opinion. So I don't think any of these numbers are surprising. And the monarchy, you know, rocks on in Australia as a successful institution. You know, I suppose if there was a referendum tomorrow, I'd be voting for an Australian republic myself. But it's not happening anytime soon. And the fact that the rebel Harry against the royal family is so unpopular will be a disincentive for others to do it. You know, it's another sign that these people live a privileged life. Don't rock the boat.
Let's talk tennis. We talked tennis yesterday. We talked the top 10 world's best tennis players of all time yesterday. Geez, some names came up. And it was as a result of one of tennis's greatest players. Rafael Nadal announced his retirement after the Davis Cup finals in November of this year, known as the King of Clay for his 14 French Open titles. Nadal's illustrious career spanned 23 years and included 22 Grand Slam victories. Gee whiz, I tell you what, aren't we going to miss the likes of Nadal, Djokovic, Federer, all these people that have recently retired or announced their retirement?
Yeah, we probably haven't realised how fortunate we've been in this golden era of male players who not only were incredibly skilled and successful on the court, but are seen as wonderful ambassadors for their sport. The big three, Djokovic, Federer and Nadal. Only Djokovic remains. I think he's in a final trying to win his 100th tournament tonight. So he's been incredible. But Nadal, I read, spent more time number one world tennis player than any other male. So there's an argument to say he's been the greatest of all time. To be the longest serving number one when you're up against Federer and Djokovic for most of that time is incredible, along with those Grand Slams that he won, including 14 in the French Open. So, you'd have to say he's been a tremendous athlete, a wonderful ambassador for his sport. And he'll be very much missed. The ones that have come since, Alcatraz and Sinner and the like, they look like pygmies, don't they, against the big three? You know, it'll take a while, I think, for male tennis to recover and find another golden era.
I listened to a podcast last week, and it was a fairly lengthy interview that Mark Boris did with Nick Kyrgios. And he's on his way back. I suppose the Australian Open will be the first major tournament that he's played in more than 12 months. So he was talking about his approach to, you know, getting back onto the circuit. And I suppose many Australians would be hoping for big things from Nick Kyrgios.
Yeah, well, he's incredibly skilled, and if he'd lived up to that skill, he'd be well positioned now to be the world number one himself. But, you know, in any walk of life, skill and ability is not enough. You need dedication and resilience. I mentioned being a great ambassador for a sport. I think a lot of Australians have got some reservations about Nick Kyrgios in that regard, some of the things he's said and done. He's certainly a radical figure who does some unusual things, like just dropping out, as he has in recent times. So he's a wasted talent, isn't he? I mean, he could have been one of the Australian greats and restore Australian male tennis. We dominated, of course, in the 50s, 60s, and well into the 70s with our male players. And unfortunately, Kyrgios hasn't walked in that tradition. So I hope he does come back. I hope he wins the Australian Open and fulfills his potential. But at the moment, I see him as a bit of a sad case.
There was an article written during the week, and it was done with the top 10 tennis players of all time. Look, the author of the article obviously was probably in their 30s or 40s. So you mentioned the 50s, the 60s and the 70s. There weren't a lot of names from those decades in the top 10. Have you got a couple of players that stand out for you as the greatest of all time?
Well, you go to Rod Laver, who had an incredible record, twice won the Grand Slam, and if he'd been in the full professional era, would have done that many more times. So he was incredible. The Rockhampton Rocket, they called him. So you think of Laver, Borg, McEnroe, Sampras, and the three that we've mentioned, Federer and Nadal and Djokovic. Is this the article where they said Nadal wouldn't be in the top 10?
Yeah, no, Nadal, Nadal made number 7, not the top 5.
Not the top 5. Well, maybe 7's a reasonable ranking, but you'd certainly have him in the top 10. And the names that I've mentioned, I can't think of many more that would be more prominent or acknowledged than those ones. So, yeah, we're losing one of the greatest players of all time in Nadal. In an era when the competition was as fierce as it was. But like Rod Laver had a lot of tough competition back in the day, Lou Hode and those sorts of players. Ken Rosewell, another Australian great.
John Newcombe
came a bit after Laver. He was certainly outstanding. Jimmy Connors in the 70s dominated. I think on that list of who was the number one for the longest period of time, as Nadal was the top and then Jimmy Connors. So he's someone we should also acknowledge.
All right, Mark, good to talk to you, mate. Are you going to watch the Bathurst race this afternoon? Are you a car racing fanatic?
No, I'm not. My car knowledge and interests are, will it start and get me from A to B? My own car. No, I don't watch the car racing. I never have. But, you know, if you're talking tennis or obviously the rugby league we talk and the cricket season coming up, horse racing, I love them all, but car racing, you can't fit them all in, can you?
It's changed so much. My wife and I were only talking about it the other day. I mean, the race used to start, I think, at about 8 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
And now it starts at 11:30.
Doesn't it go all day? It doesn't start in the morning.
No, it starts at 11:30. The celebrations, go all day, but the official start for the race is 11:30.
Well, I hope they have a good race. It's a big thing for Bathurst, and I hope it's a great success and they all safely complete it. But no, I won't be watching. I've got something else to do.
Always good to talk to you, mate. Okay. Have a good week.
All the best.
We'll catch up with you next week. That is Mark Latham and our regular weekly chat.